Wow, Joanna Robinson. Wow.
Wow.
That is all I have to say.
That's it? Is that the end of the podcast?
That's the end of the podcast. That's the end of the podcast of A Cast of Kings. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to an unofficial Game of Thrones podcast. My name is David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
My name is Joanna Robinson. I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And I'm kind of grateful that I haven't read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire, because I did not see that one coming, Joanna. I got to say, I did not see that one coming.
And I feel very proud. I feel semi-responsible. Like, I helped shield you from
you're like Bambi's
spoilers.
Mom, protecting Bambi, you know, from the dangers of the world.
I do know. That makes me sound really badass.
Yeah. No, and things ended well for her. So, if you're just tuning in to A Cast of Kings for the first time, you can find more of our episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com, as many of you did last evening, which is when the episode Reigns of Castamere aired. If if you don't know how things work here, we will spoil everything through this week's episode of Game of Thrones, but we will not spoil anything from future week's episodes of Game of Thrones. That includes anything in the next time on preview on HBO. It includes anything from future books of Game of Thrones, future plot developments shall remain unspoiled. So I guess before we get into this week's episode, let's just say that in my opinion, and maybe I'm wrong about this, Joanna, I'll probably be proven wrong about this, but in my opinion, this is going to be one of those like seminal defining moments of television that people are talking about years from now. Right, that you remember when you saw it for the first time, like the series finale of Seinfeld or the series finale of Sopranos. Like, this will become of that level.
Well, right? One of my favorite things that we got from emails from people were people who recounted where they were when they read that chapter in the book. We got more than one email about that, of like, I remember where I was when I read the Red Wedding chapter in Storm of Swords, and this is what was happening to me. And yeah, and I definitely remember where I was, and I agree with you that the TV watching experience is similar. I am astonished that any of you made it through unspoiled. I am proud of you all and really amazed that people made it this far without being spoiled.
Pat from Maryland had a very nice email he sent to us. He said, I assume your email inbox is exploding. Thank you for reading all these emails from your sullied and unsullied listeners. I must say, it's a testament to your podcast that while I am watching the episode, while my wife is pulling up a blanket near her eyes when Black Walder is closing the doors to the hall, I was focusing on this thought. I hope no one spoiled David Chen. And Pat, that's very heartwarming that he cared so much about my not being spoiled. And I will say, I was pretty much unspoiled. Like, there were certain elements of tonight that had kind of been spoiled in advance for me. I will say that. As I mentioned, we're spoiling everything through this week's episode, okay? Season 3, episode 9. So, you know, you should know by now that we're going to be talking about the plot details. But I will say, I did kind of know beforehand that Roose Bolton was not on the level, as it were, right? So I kind of knew that there was a reveal coming in that regard, but I did not know that it would be a reveal of this magnitude. And we'll leave it at that. So, Twitter exploded last night.
There's been
tons of people with reactions on YouTube. And it's been pretty amusing to read a lot of the reactions. People getting so emotional about the show. And that's when you know a show is effective, right? That's when you know a show has really got its claws in you, because you care so much about these characters. You feel like they're real people. You start to root for them, right? And when they're taken away from you, it feels like an injustice has been done to you.
Well, and it's bigger. It's even bigger than season one Ned Stark surprise, because thousands and thousands upon millions of more people are invested in the show now since season one.
Right.
You know, that was pretty shocking.
Also the magnitude of the body count was significantly higher this time around as well.
It was, but I mean the Ned Stark thing from season one. And we had an interesting email, and I'm sorry, I don't remember who it was from, asking us to compare the various episode nines of the three seasons, because we had Baelor, which is from season one, which is Ned Stark's beheading. We had Blackwater in season two, and then Reigns of Castamere here. And compare them. And I think with the Sean Bean death, it was astonishing in that everyone who hadn't read the book considered Sean Bean the main character of the show.
Yeah, the protagonist.
I mean, Rob and Catelyn are not the heroes of the story, but everyone
not
thought
to you they're not, Joanna.
Okay, if Catelyn was your favorite, I'm so sorry for your loss, Dave.
That's right.
But Ned Stark was our hero. Sean Bean was the biggest name in the cast, and Ned Stark was our hero, and they killed him. And so the body count may not have been as high, but I don't know that you can say the magnitude wasn't as great, you know?
Okay. I can see that argument. I think it was Miles McNutt drew an interesting parallel in his review at Cultural Learnings. He was talking about how when you compare that to, like, Blackwater, there was no real shocks in Blackwater in terms of, like, plot-wise. Like, no one really major died. Davos' son died. But, you know, like, it wasn't on the same scale as Ned or Robb Stark. Blackwater was just a really well-executed hour of television. Right. But there was nothing that, like, changed the plot in ways that were totally mind-blowing. I mean, there was a big twist with the fire. But, you know, aside from that, it was just kind of a really greatly well-done episode of Game of Thrones. And kind of a nice mini war movie, a war short film, as it were. But this is something that's going to reconfigure the entire plot and probably structure of the show, right, from this point on. Can I ask, like, what your situation was when you watched the show?
What my situation was?
Yeah, like, did you see it with people? You know, did you talk about it with people after? Like, how did you experience this?
Yeah, I had some friends over, but everyone knew what was coming. Like, everyone who was over has read the books, so they knew. But we were all very excited. And then, yeah, I talked to some people, and I was enjoying the hell out of people's reactions on Twitter and that sort of stuff. And then you watched with your girlfriend, right?
I watched it with my girlfriend and my parents, and my parents happened to be visiting me from Boston. They were staying in my apartment in Seattle. And when we got done with the episode, my dad just happened to be chilling by the TV, and he's just watching with me. And when we got done, I said, "So, Dad, what did you think?" And he said, "Yeah, it was good, but I got really confused because I thought those guys were the main characters of the show. And clearly they're not because they were just killed off." And I said, "No, Dad. No, they were the main characters."
And now they're gone.
They were main characters. And they're just totally eliminated. So,
but what I will say is that this is only two-thirds of the way through the book.
Right.
So there's more to come next season.
Right. Yeah. So I am curious how they're going to stretch out. What one-third of the book stretched out to a whole season will feel like compared to two-thirds of a book, but I'm guessing they're probably going to draw from season four stuff as well. Or, I'm sorry, book four stuff as well?
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. I think that would be the smart thing to do.
All right. So those were overall reactions. It was just like, this felt like a moment, like a momentous moment in TV history.
I want to compare it to another moment in TV history, but we are very cautious about spoiling other series. So,
can you say what series it is at least?
Yeah, The Wire.
Okay.
There is an episode of The Wire that's what I would liken this to.
Okay, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
So you say The Wire, I say Sopranos and
Seinfeld.
Seinfeld. Okay. This was the moon landing of TV episodes, although that was also on TV. That's not a very good analogy, but you get the point. Is that
in that it was faked? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. In that Stanley Kubrick made it. Okay. although on a more serious note, David Nutter directed last night's episode of Game of Thrones, and he is a cool director. He did a lot of X-Files, right? And he did the film Disturbing Behavior, which very few people haven't seen, or very few people have seen.
I've seen it.
He also did. How was that movie, by the way?
Nick Stahl, right? That's a great movie. Yeah. No, it's not a good movie, but this is a great episode.
He did an episode of The Sopranos. He did some Entourage. So he's like a very talented TV director, right? And I think that those skills were certainly on display for The Reigns of Castamere. So I think we got to dive into the episode, Joanna Robinson. I think
let's
we got to dive
it.
In. Let's start at the beginning, as we usually do, and go scene by scene. So you point out here in the show notes, Joanna, that in the opening credits, there is a new location.
Right. I'm not sure. I mean, we saw the twins in season one when they went there. But, you know, once again, for those of us who've read the books, when the twins cropped up in the opening credits, it was like, dun, dun, dun. Not that we didn't know what was coming, but that's, you know, that's where this all went down, is the twins, where the Freys live. And there it was in the opening credits.
So that was cool. And we also saw like the typical locations that we've seen throughout the rest of the season. Yunkai was there as well. And that was going to become much more prominently featured in this episode.
Right.
So we begin with Rob and Kat at the table talking about kind of the plan to, is it to take Castle Rock, correct?
Right, right.
Which is the Lannister's home. Right.
Right.
And so Rob is thinking to himself, yes, we're going to do this thing. And, you know, Catelyn Stark has that line, like, show them what it means to lose something they love. And you get all, like, psyched up, you know? I think to myself, man, maybe these guys are going to succeed in this crazy gambit. That's what most television shows would do. They get you pumped up. And then when it happens, you feel so much satisfaction that, you know, the forces of good have triumphed over the forces of evil. And clearly that's where this episode was heading.
Obviously. Obviously.
So what do you make of this scene, Joanna? What did you think of it?
Well, I liked it. I mean, it happens in the book, too, where Rob is sort of planning this whole war strategy. It's a George R. R. Martin fake out, I think. But it's a nice last moment, really, between Rob and Kat. And he does have some nice concessions that he gives her where he says, you know, you were right about a lot of things. And I'm sorry, I made a lot of mistakes.
Little did she know how right she was.
There you go.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was interesting. And I don't know, Jonah, should we mention this detail about the chess pieces?
I'm going to leave that up to you.
Okay. You're going to leave it up to me. We should have talked about this beforehand, but I guess I'll say that it is really hard to ignore the fact. I think here's my argument, Jonah, and I made this to you last night. I don't think you really bought it. But I would say that the camera lingers on one of those chess pieces in a way that draws your attention to it, and that may reveal details about other plot lines in ways that I don't think it really has the rest of the season. Like, the rest of the season, can I just leave it at that? I think that's vague enough, but still,
okay.
Like, says something.
But pointed,
right?
Yes.
Which is that when you look at those chess pieces, there's some really interesting detail there, and I would argue that this is the first time this season that detail has really been focused on, literally.
Okay.
I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Okay. So moving on. So then we cut to this scene with Walter Frey and Robb Stark kind of having an audience together, talking
right.
about what is going on. And I start to get the sense when I'm watching this that this is going to focus heavily on this plot line, this episode,
okay.
right?
Uh-huh.
So do you want to explain what guest rights are, Joanna Robinson?
Yeah. This is something that they showed but didn't really explain. So for people who haven't read the books may not have gotten it. But what I told Dave last night is it reminds me a lot of Greek mythology. So maybe people picked up on it anyway. But the idea is that Rob and Kat and Edmure and Brendan and Talisa and Walder all eat some bread and salt. And then Walder says this thing. He says, I extend to you my hospitality and protection in the light of the seven, which has to do with guest rights, which means if you break bread with a guest under your roof, then they are protected and safe. So what comes to pass later constitutes Walder Frey breaking a very, very important rule of hospitality in Westeros, which is that once you've broken bread with a guest, you do not riddle their bodies with arrows.
Yes. Yes.
So that was something that they sort of showed.
Can you think
explain.
Of any equivalent in modern day to that? Like, I've been trying to think of, like, what is a modern day equivalent that, like, you know? I guess.
But
the idea is that he's done something, like, he is saying, I will not harm you under threat of, shall we say, eternal damnation? You know, shall we say something really terrible? Right?
Well, it's like breaking amnesty laws. You know what I mean? It's just, I don't know. It's an understood custom. So it's a huge deal that he breaks that, basically.
Right.
So, That's all. I don't know that there's necessarily a modern equivalent because we don't really have as much honor anymore.
It would be like if a country. It would be like if a country had a constitution that gave every one of its citizens the right to a trial in the event of something bad happening, but then that country started just killing people indiscriminately without trial. I mean,
we would never do that.
That never happens. Topical.
No.
So in any case, it is kind of him saying, like, you are under my protection. And I believe in the book, Joanna, from what I've heard from the comments, is that Talisa was very – or the equivalent of Talisa was very keen on this or something like that. Like, one of the
Jane's not even there. Kat was.
And was Kat very keen that this happened?
Yes. Kat is very nervous the entire time. Like, she is very nervous about the phrase the entire time. And she wants Rob's direwolf there, and she wants, like, every – you know, she is just very vigilant. So, yes.
Does she have a reason to think that Frey is going to, you know, repay them with treachery in this instance? Like,
given what she knows about Walder Frey, which we saw in season one, when they made the promise in the first place, Catelyn, from the start, was like – this is very important. Do not cross Walder Frey. You will be fucked if you do. You know? And then Rob did it anyway.
I guess what I'm asking you is, like, is there something, like, has Walder Frey done horrible things that that would justify this reputation? Or does she just kind of say that and then we kind of take it for granted?
He's a horrible human being.
Okay, yeah. Yes. I mean, that's true. That's very clear. So they have this conversation, and Rob apologizes, and Walder Frey does this thing where he brings out all these women, right? That one of which Rob theoretically would have married, right?
Right.
And I gotta say, I remember that scene. It was very significant, you know, like it kind of burned its way into my memory of how when Kat told Rob that she was promising his hand in marriage, and Rob says, have you seen his daughters? And she says, you know, there was one that was not horrible. And then Walder Frey brings up these women, and look, I mean, very few of them I would qualify as supermodels, but they're not, like, I was expecting a lot worse.
You were expecting them to be hideous.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, would you agree with that assessment, right? Like, I didn't think any of them was particularly like, oh my God, that's horrifying, do you know?
No, none of them were like oozing something
had
humps.
So yeah. I guess what I'm saying is that Catelyn was very hyperbolic in the way she communicated their looks. Okay?
No, I feel like we saw them in season one, though, didn't we?
Yeah, they're totally acceptable. Do you know what I mean?
They're like frumpy.
Yeah, they're frumpy. There's nothing wrong with that. Do you know? Some guys are into that kind of stuff.
Some guys like the frump, so it's okay.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? So that was kind of like I thought to myself, wow, that's not a bad situation, you know what I mean? As bad as we originally thought. Now, is Edmure's ultimate wife, like, is she drawn from this pool? I don't recall.
She is, yeah. Okay. Roslyn, yeah.
Okay. I guess they just made her look less attractive in that scene, right?
Oh, no. I mean, she's not in that scene.
Oh, she's not in the scene, but...
Right. But she is a Frey.
I see. Okay. So then...
I know, and I like that part where, like, he couldn't remember one of their name. And, like, a lot of them are named Walda. He's Walder. A lot of them are named Walda.
Yep.
Like, a lot of his are. So he's like, Walda, Waldina, I don't really know. Nice. That was a nice little bit of comedy. But then there was that very creepy moment where he starts talking to Talisa. Right. And he says, I always know what's going on underneath a dress, which was disgusting. And you and I talked about whether or not that was simply I can determine the shape of your body underneath that dress, or if it was like I can tell that you have a baby. Like,
right.
We talked about that last night, right?
Love. That's what the Starks of Winterfell call him, eh? Very honorable. I call it a pretty face. Very pretty. Prettier than this lot, that's for sure. Very shapely as well. Oh, you try to hide her under that dress. If you wanted to hide her, you shouldn't have brought her here in the first place. I can always see what's going on beneath a dress. Been at this a long time. I bet when you take that dress off, everything stays right where it is. Doesn't drop an inch. Your king says he betrayed me for love. I say he betrayed me for firm tits and a tight fit. And I can respect that. When I was your age, I'd have broken 50 oaths to get into that without a second thought.
Right, yeah, yeah. I think it was James Poniewozik at Time.com who pointed this out. That is that a hint that he knows that she has a baby? Because theoretically, no one would necessarily know at this point. It's not like she had a baby shower or anything.
Right.
So later on, when someone goes straight for the belly, it's like they know that she's pregnant, right?
Right.
So it, maybe that's what Walter Fry is talking about here. It's a very creepy scene.
Yes.
And talking about like what it is that, Walter is trying to make this as uncomfortable as possible for Rob, because as we'll find out very definitively later, Walter Fry is not a man who forgives easily, right? And he clearly felt grievously wronged by Rob's breaking of that vow.
And I mean, we should give a shout out to the casting department, because David Bradley, the actor who plays Walter Frey, who a lot of people know as Filch from Harry Potter, he's a great British character actor. And when he showed up in season one, I was like, yes, they nailed it. Like, because, you know, I knew he was going to coming back, but I was just like, yes, he's going to be so creepy and terrible and it's going to be fantastic. So.
Excellent.
Yeah.
By the way, Twitter user Lewis F. tweets at us a really good example. I don't remember if you said this just now, but Jonah, but he says, modern version of guest rights is the rules and customs governing diplomats. Violating them is a big effing deal.
Diplomatic immunity.
Or like an embassy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In another country, exactly. Right? Violating that space.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a good analogy, Lewis. Thank you for that. So anyway, they have this very uncomfortable chat. And kind of Walter Frey commenting lasciviously, saying things like, you know, I can understand why you broke your vow for this piece of meat type of thing. And generally being very crude.
Yeah.
Generally being very crude and misogynistic and just not a good person. But whatever, you know, throughout this scene, I'm thinking to myself, okay, Walter, you kind of, he wronged you. You're right. You've had your fun. I'm glad we put that behind us.
You thought this is as far as Walter Frey's.
That's as far as it's going to go. Everything's going to be okay after, you know, ha ha ha, you rascal. You're so incorrigible. You're incorrigible, Walter.
So. Yeah, and then he says, the wine will flow red at the wedding is something that he says. So that was cheery.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah.
So let's get to the conclusion of that plotline later on. Let's talk about the Yunkai plotline, General Robinson.
Okay. Let's do it.
So
this is when I started crying, by the way.
Interesting. So throughout this episode, so I had heard that something big was going to happen. Like, we assumed that something big is going to happen in episode 9. You, from the very beginning, have said, David Chen, anyone who has read the books knows how the season is going to end.
Right.
You're so very annoyingly confident, Jonah Robinson.
I'm sorry.
And so I knew something big was going to happen. And so my mind thought, is it going to be like Blackwater? You know, is it going to be this huge war?
Right.
This huge sacking of the city? And so the whole episode, I'm looking for, like, what is the big thing?
I know, that's so annoying. And, this speaks to the larger spoiler issue of, like, even if I don't say anything about what's coming but tell you something's coming in episode 9, you're distracted looking for what's coming.
I actually don't think I was really that bothered by it. I'm just saying, like, I knew it was going to be something big. I was looking for it. But I agree in general that we should not say, oh, something big is coming, guys. I agree with that.
Well, the other thing I'll say is that the code name for this sequence is the Red Wedding. And a lot of people felt like they could just say the Red Wedding and that's not spoiling anything. But you're wrong. Then you're like, okay, I'm looking at this wedding. Okay, the color red. Okay, there's going to be a lot of blood at this wedding. You know, like, I just feel like no one should have said Red Wedding in public.
I agree. No, I agree completely with you.
That was my feeling.
I agree completely. And I'm grateful you never said it. And I can say that with great thankfulness that I had never heard the term Red Wedding until last night.
Good.
So, I avoided all talk. It's actually not that, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say it's not that difficult, but I make a conscious effort to avoid it, right? And our listeners, thank goodness, are, for the most part, really respectful. So yeah. I do appreciate that. So thank you, guys. So the whole episode, I'm looking like, is this going to be it? Is this going to be, is the Yunkai thing going to be the equivalent of Blackwater, right? Is that what's happening? We did get a scene of total badassery by these characters, right?
Yeah.
By Dario, Jorah, and Grey Worm carving their way through a bunch of Yunkai slaves, right?
Right.
And that was awesome. But I guess, I mean, the show is kind of, I'm guessing there's two rationales. Number one is, like, so correct me if I'm wrong, Jonah, but my guess is that in the book, there's a huge sacking scene or whatever.
No, not really.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, no. But I mean, the difference is, and what's irritating to me as an obnoxious feminist, is that the sacking of the city is Danny's idea. And in this, it's like Dario's idea, right? It's Dario's idea and Dario's execution. In the book, Danny is like, Danny gets the sellswords drunk and has them distracted and then goes in the dead of night, has her people go in the dead of night and sack the city, basically. And in this, it's all Dario's orchestration. But what I will say about the fighting is I loved what they had with Grey Worm doing with a spear fighting. I thought that was really cool. You know I love Ian Glenn, so I loved the Jorah fighting. I thought that was really cool as well. So
yeah,
I agree. It was
a fun scene. So my thinking was, they didn't want to pack this episode with too much stuff.
Right.
And also for budgetary reasons, right? Like, it's much easier to show one scene of people fighting as a proxy for sacking the entire city,
right?
Than it is to show sacking the entire city.
Right.
And I will say, you know, I bought it. I'm willing to be very forgiving and very understanding of the show when it does stuff like this. I understand the budget's not eternal and infinite. I get it.
No, but it's just like this in the book where Jorah comes back and she's like, how did it go? And he's like, it went great. We won.
Or
like,
did it.
You know.
Or did it.
But poor Jorah, like I said, this is where I started crying. I thought Ian Glenn's face, his crestfallen, blood-spattered face, and she's like, what did you call him? You called him Fabio, right? Fabio Naharis. Where she was like, where's Fabio? Basically. And Jorah's poor, crumpled, sad face. Oh, it killed me.
Well, at first, when I saw it, I thought he was thinking to himself, oh, he's dead, and I'm sorry to have to report this news to you. But then he's not dead. He stepped aside. And then you realize why he was really sad.
Right, yeah.
Is that Danny seemed to care so much for the Fabio guy.
Yeah.
So I guess I gotta ask this question, Joanna Robinson, which is like, you know, you had a hard time buying the Ygritte Jon Snow romance.
Yes.
Like, do you believe that Dany would care this much about this character at this point when we only met him one episode ago?
I think she just wants to bone him. She has a type. It's a long-haired, pretty boy type. I don't think we're supposed to think of it as a great romance, or maybe we are. I don't know. But I think.
I think if we are, then it's not succeeding.
Yeah, sure. Mostly, I think we're supposed to feel sorry for Jorah, who we've followed for as long as we have.
I mean, we followed him for like dozens of episodes trying to get in Danny's pants, and this guy just waltzes along, waltzes in the tent, and it's all his.
With his shiny hair.
Yeah.
Ugh, the worst.
I know, seriously. I hate those people. So, yes, Jorah's disgust is totally understandable and very sad. But overall, did you think that the execution of this sequence was effective?
I mean, yeah, it was enjoyable. I liked the amount of fighting we saw. I thought it was great. It communicated a lot of points efficiently. So I liked it, yeah.
So then we go to the Sam and Gilly plot. And they have this cute conversation where it's kind of the one thing I take away from this scene is she kind of has this comment about how you looked at a bunch of markings on a page and then you learned all that stuff. And I realized when I saw that when I saw this scene, dude, reading is freaking awesome, man. You don't realize how awesome it is until you talk to someone who doesn't know how to read, right?
Does that mean you're starting to like grow into your love and respect for Sam?
No.
Damn it. Well, Gilly is. She thinks he's a wizard because he can read and he knows where the secret gate is to the Knight's for it. So,
well, I think there was also the thing that did he always want to be a wizard, right? That was part of the plot. Am I just making that up?
I think you made that up.
Okay. I think I'm getting this confused with Harry Potter, but
okay.
But in any case, their relationship is blossoming. So sure. That's all that's important.
Okay.
And I think that's basically going to take us halfway there, Jonah Robinson.
Yeah.
I think we can get to it. So as you guys know who are listening to this podcast, and let me just say, for those of you who are tuning in, I feel like there's a lot of people, there's like a couple hundred people listening right now, and who might not know what the podcast is, listening to us on Hangouts Live. This is the Cast of Kings podcast. You can find us at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. You find all of our episodes there. And you can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. This season of A Cast of Kings was made possible only by the generosity of people on Kickstarter. We are incredibly grateful to all of them. Several people elected to sponsor episodes of Game of Thrones. And today, our sponsor is MidwestFilmNerds.com. That's MidwestFilmNerds.com, which is two people from Michigan, including Alex and his friend Willie, oftentimes Nick, doing amateur film criticism by pretty nerdy people. And I will say I'm very sympathetic to causes such as this because that is how I first got started in podcasting at the /Filmcast. You know, you can find their website at MidwestFilmNerds.com. You can also find them on Twitter at MidwestPodNet. That's at MidwestPodNet. John Robinson, I mean, you're relatively new to the podcasting game.
I am.
When it compares to myself.
It's true.
Which is to say, I've only been doing it for a few years. So it's not like I'm like super seasoned or anything like that. But I mean, you probably have felt the scrappy nature of podcasting, right? And kind of what that feels like to grow a podcast from nothing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what Alex is doing at MidwestFilmNerds.com. So Jonah Robinson, do you sort of have any thoughts on how someone just starting out can succeed in this dog-eat-dog world of podcasting?
Oh, gosh. I guess what I've learned from you and from my own experience is that interacting with your listeners is the best way to grow your listenership, I think, and sort of building a community. And I listened to a bit of the Midwest Film Nerds, and they're great. They're adorable. They're lovely. And I think you guys would really dig them. I think they're really great and sort of right up everyone who listens to us. It's right up their alley.
Their collective alleyway.
Yes.
It is up it.
Exactly. I would recommend giving them a shot, and you know, if they want tips from me, I would say engage with your listeners because, you know, our listeners are awesome. Engaging with them is half the fun. So
definitely. So MidwestFilmNerds.com is where you can find their website. You can also find them on Twitter at MidwestPodNet. And episodes usually out every Wednesday, available in iTunes and I'm sure other podcast formats. Also, we're just getting in this hot tweet from Daniel Wood.
Shut up! Damn it!
From Daniel Wood, who says, Sam said he wanted to be a wizard when he grew up in the show. John laughed. Dave was right. Go, Dave. So, John Robinson, you just got served.
Oh. What was I just saying about our listeners being the best? Maybe they're the worst. Oh, how dare you contradict me, listeners.
Anyway, Alex, thanks so much for your sponsorship this week. MidwestFilmNerds.com at MidwestPodNet. We also got to thank all the people that donated $10 to the show, claim the $10 reward. I will say this. This is going to be our last butchering of your names on Game of Thrones. Next week, there's going to be a sponsor, but there's no names next week. If for some reason we did not read your name, we forgot it, or something terrible happened, email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. We'll make sure we read it next week, okay? So this week, we want to thank the following people. Colleen O'Hara, Jesse of House Snow, Min Yang, Mario Rivera, Rachel Mercer, Lisa Hawthorne, Julio Apria, Alan Stramel, Jack Daniels, yes, my parents are nuts, Jack says, and Darren Lee. Thank you guys so much for your donations.
And I would like to thank Jerry Covarrubias, Anand Patel, John D. in New Jersey, Ivan Morales, Cecilia Cullen, Andreas Kuhn. I listened to his pronunciation guide, and that's how it goes. Eitan Greenbaum, Jason, quote-unquote, what happened to the Justified cast, Fung, and Jeremy Fogelman. Thank you guys so much.
Were you, like, trying to pronounce those names in the ethnicity accent that they were supposed to be in?
Yes, as any responsible person would. But Andreas Kuhn, like, sent us this little audio file, and I listened to it, like, five times to try to get it right. So don't say I didn't do my research.
Don't imitate people of other races, Joanna Robinson. That is good advice in general. I'm just saying, just for general. I'm not saying you did a bad job just now. I'm just putting that out there for the future.
Wow. Okay.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
So thanks to all the people who donated to us on Kickstarter. You can, if we did not read your name over the course of the last 9 episodes, please feel free to email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Let us know, and we will make it right. But really appreciate all the people that made this podcast possible. Because I got a lot of tweets last night saying that a lot of people donated to the podcast just to eventually hear this episode of the podcast, knowing what was going to happen. So in a sense, this episode that we're recording right now is the culmination of a dream, Joanna Robinson. All right, let's move on. A couple of other big plot lines kind of started to resolve themselves this episode. We got a scene with Bran, Rickon, Asha, Hodor, and the Reeds kind of in the tower. There's thunder going on, and then the wildlings show up. Actually, no, I should say before that, there was that scene with the old the old guy who keeps the horses, right?
Right, right.
And Jon Snow is doing his best to be like, oh, don't kill him, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And he kind of, like, Ygritte is about to kill him, and Jon kind of distracts her, and she doesn't kill him. Now, do you think that he... let me just say, first of all, I thought John made a noble effort to spare this person's life.
He did. I liked the thing he did as they were running up to the guy's house. John sort of hit the rocks in the ground with his sword to spook the horses and warn the guy, which right. I thought was really smart thinking. So I thought that was cool.
Yeah, that was
cool.
I liked
that.
And so do you think Ygritte missed on purpose, or do you think she accidentally missed because John startled her?
I think she missed because John startled her.
All right. All right. So, you know, they have this scene where they steal the horses and John's loyalty is starting to come into question. Then they arrive and for, you know, I think the first time in a really long time, we get two of the plot lines converging, right? Two of the Stark brothers plot lines converging.
Yeah.
Which I don't think has happened in quite some time, if ever, since they parted ways. This is the closest that Bran and John have ever been. Geographically to each other, and also like Bran was kind of like John's favorite or vice versa, right? I remember from season one their goodbye was quite poignant, if I recall.
No, it's John and Arya.
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah. My bad. I got Bran and Arya confused. I'm sorry about that.
It's okay.
I'm sorry about that. But Bran is okay with John, right? So
they're cool.
They're cool with each other.
They're cool. No, I mean, they did have a point in goodbye. Like, John goes to say goodbye to Bran, and Kat's like, get the fuck out.
Yeah,
I
that's
hate
right.
your face.
That's right. That's so what I was thinking that. Of. That's yeah, what yeah. I was thinking of. That's what I was yeah. thinking of. So a lot of things happening in this scene, right? First of all, like, one question we had was, Jojen Reed's like, dude, you gotta get inside the minds of these wolves, man. So Bran demonstrates his power by kind of knocking out Hodor. Now, what is this called, Joanna Robinson, in the show?
Warging.
It's kind of like The Shining, basically, right? Or The Shining.
Sure. The Shining.
It's the equivalent of The Shining.
Skin changing, I think, is the other word for it.
And
so.
Is it a spoiler to say what the process is that's actually happening here? Is like, is he just using telepathy? Is he using telekinesis? Like,
well, it's like he's inside. It's what he does with the wolves and what Orel does with his eagle, the wildling Orel who dies in this episode. It's like being able to go inside it's like the Beastmaster, if anyone is fond of that movie, which I am. Being able to go inside something else. But what should be noted is that warging is a thing that is done by several characters in this universe, warging like into an animal. Bran is the only one to ever do it to another human.
I see.
So it's a big deal.
Well, Jojen Reed says, yeah. He said, dude, you were able to do Hodor. You were able to warg Hodor just now. Like, doing a wolf is, like, way easier, basically, right?
Yeah.
And so the whole time I'm thinking, why doesn't Jojen just do this stuff, right? Why doesn't Jojen warg into one of the direwolves? Is that ever explained?
Or... Jojen has different skills.
I see. That are not warging.
Right.
But he knows about Bran's warging. That's Jojen's skill.
Yeah,
he can figure out people who warg.
He knows shit.
he knows people who warg. He can't warg himself, but he knows who can.
Jojen has something called green dreams. He has these prophetic dreams.
I see.
So that's a different skill set.
So then Bran has this kind of somewhat cliche scene where, right, someone's saying, you can do it. You have the power. And then he finally seizes control of the direwolf and kind of is able to protect Jon. Now, one might ask, why were the direwolves just chilling in the first place? But whatever. Fine. Bran has this big moment. And actually, speaking of big moments, we also forgot to mention Rickon had a big moment this episode, right, Joanna?
He spoke.
Now, my question for you is Rickon such a waste of a character in the books, or is he actually like well defined?
Asha and Rickon leave way earlier, so the fact that they're around in this season at all is not canon.
I see.
So, you know, Asha and Rickon leave at the end of this episode or midway through this episode, but they shouldn't really be in the season at all.
I see.
So, yeah.
So you don't think that the show really did anything to take away from Rickon's character?
No. Right. He's like a feral little weird child. So,
well, he does have that scene where he's like, no, I don't want to go. I'm supposed to protect you. And I kept thinking to myself, this scene would mean a lot more to me if I gave a crap or could use even two adjectives to describe Rickon.
That feral.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I just know he's a vacancy of a character.
He's feral and he's the youngest. And his wolf's name is Shaggy Dog. That's all you need to know about Rickon. So
I will say that him saying goodbye to Asha meant a lot more to me. Like, you know, I mean, these
Bran saying
been,
goodbye, yeah.
Yeah, and kind of that was a little bit poignant, you know, seeing them say goodbye to each other because, you know, the entire character journey of Asha, you know, she almost killed Rickon when she first met him, was taken
Bran.
In.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Bran. Yeah, sorry. Bran. And was taken in and kind of has this debt to pay to the Starks and is going to pay the debt, right? And she's very honorable and save their lives.
Yeah.
And so they've been through all these crazy adventures and now they're saying goodbye and it's very sad. So I thought that scene was quite well done. So wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. But what of this Jon Snow thing? Jon Snow, man. I don't know how to feel about this guy, Joanna Robinson. I mean, he just kind of left Ygritte high and dry there. Am I right?
Well, she killed the old man.
Yeah, she killed the old man. But the thing is, she was doing it to save Jon.
Right.
Right? Like, she knew Jon wasn't going to kill the old man.
Right.
And she knew that if he didn't, that he was doomed. Right? So she wanted to step in and save Jon. And I will say I did not see it coming that guy would be killed. What's his name? The warger?
Orel.
I did not see it coming that Orel would die. It is quite it was a shocking moment because whenever a character that's been in a show for like many episodes dies and all of a sudden without any warning, it is always shocking because most TV shows don't do that, right? Some TV shows do and it's quite refreshing to see that. But you know, not many. And so when Orel died, I was kind of like, oh, you know, I was not seeing that coming. And of course, you know, you can imagine what my reaction was like 20 minutes later when more stuff happened. So Orel dies and there's this amazing shot where Jon grabs a horse, totally ditches Ygritte and Ygritte's kind of running after him. Right. And you see the camera linger on Ygritte's eyes and it's really all about her eyes in that scene. Because in her eyes is despair, is betrayal, confusion, because she has betrayed her own people and then was subsequently betrayed by the person who she betrayed her own people for.
Sure.
And, you know, that's a painful thing to endure. What do you think of this scene?
It's I think they tried a lot harder to paint this as a really, really romantic love story in the TV show than they did in the book. And in the book, she slices the old man's throat open, or she stabs him at least. It's not as sort of clean as an arrow. It's a little more gruesome. And then she's not held back. She, like, John flees. It's not so much of a poignant, like, he ditches her. It's more, he's shown to be a coward, and then he runs off.
And, I see. Okay, but what did you think of the scene?
I know. Sorry. In the scene in the show, I really love Rose Leslie's portrayal of Ygritte. I think she's lovely. I thought it was well done. I liked that it was shot in the rain. I thought that, like, that whole thing added a whole element to the scene that I really liked. And I didn't love the special effects of the bird on John's face. I thought that was it seemed a little shoddy.
It was pretty rough. Yep.
But yeah, the poignancy was there for sure. I mean, it's just, in general, Kit Harington has not done Jon Snow justice in my mind. So I don't know. I don't feel it as much, but I do love that poignancy of the brothers being so close to each other and then missing each other.
Right.
And, I guess those are my impressions of the scene.
You know, the thing is, like, at this point, I mean, I always bought this love story more than you did. Right.
Right.
And so I did feel this scene, you know, was very powerful because regardless of how plausible you think their love affair is,
sure,
what you can't deny are Ygritte's feelings for John, right?
Yes. And Rose Leslie's performance in general.
Right. And she's clearly, like, totally in love with this guy. And the fact that he just kind of, like, ditches her is really – you can feel the pain that she's experiencing through tears in the rain. And so it's very powerful in that way. But I will say that, like, this is a scene where Jon Snow is finally tested, and it really just brought up all those memories of why the Corran Halfhand thing made no sense to me whatsoever, right?
Yeah.
Because here's a scene where, okay, this is the clearest test ever that whether or not Jon Snow is really on the Wildlings. Whereas the Corran Halfhand thing, it was not like, hey, you know, that would be, if this similar scenario happened at the end of season two, then that would be like, okay, I buy that. Where they're like, hey, guys, kill Corran Halfhand. Or, hey, John, kill Corran Halfhand. We're going to hold him here. You kill him to prove your loyalty. Right. That would be like, oh, okay, then he's proven himself. But Corran provoked John, right? John was, like, defending himself.
Right.
So it makes no sense that any of John's actions would be, you know, would have any what's it called in law, probity? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like there's no culpability there.
Self-defense, man.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So finally, the first time that John's actually tested, he doesn't pass the test, and everyone, you know, Ygritte's shocked, and everyone's like, see, I told you. And the whole time I'm thinking to myself, dude, you guys could have figured this out literally 9 episodes ago. But whatever. Rose Leslie and Ygritte's, you know, eyes and disappointment and her tears of sadness. That's all that really matters for the scene. Okay?
Okay.
We'll leave it at that.
Okay.
And so we finally get to the wedding itself. Now, before we get to the wedding, we have this nice little scene with Arya and the Hound, right? Where they're kind of approaching the wedding.
Right.
And you just I kind of got this feeling, right, that, like, dude, you know, Arya is like the equivalent of Gilligan, man. She is never going to get off that island. And where the island is the equivalent of, you know,
being separated from her family.
That's right.
Okay.
And so, you know, I didn't feel like it was going to be a good ending. Anyway, you just get this bad feeling because the show doesn't really traffic in great, joyful, triumphant moments in general.
Right.
But we did just get that,
I liked the parallel, like, how they orchestrated this episode, because you have the parallels of Bran and Jon getting so close to each other and Arya getting so close to her family. And then you also have these parallels of Jon trying to defend this old man, this old horse breeder, and Arya defending the hog farmer against the Hound. You know what I mean? Like, the Stark children are out in the world trying to protect old innocent men from being butchered out in the world. And we had it earlier this season with Brienne, who let that old man go. You know what I mean? It's right. Sort of this thing that comes up over and over again, that there's the type of person who doesn't think twice about killing an old man just in case he tells on them. And then there are the kind of people who are like, no, let's wait a tick, you know?
Right. And the people that say wait a tick, they're always the one that gets screwed over.
They do.
The Hound says to Arya, you're almost there and you're afraid you won't make it. The closer you get, the worse the fear gets. And this is actually an actual phenomenon in modern psychology, John Robinson.
Oh, is it?
The idea of counterfactual thinking, right? The idea that if you miss a bus by 5 minutes or by 30 seconds, let's say, you feel worse than if you miss a bus by 30 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Because the brain is able to think of the counterfactual. The brain is able to think, oh, I could have, you know, made the bus. I could have done X, Y, Z if only I had done this, 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 right? Whereas if the separation is big enough, right, if the gulf is big enough, you don't feel that way. You think you can't conceive of a scenario where it would have worked out, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so here, you know, she keeps looking at the twins, not wanting them to disappear, right? And by the way, is there any significance behind the name the twins?
Well, it's just like it's two towers on either side of the crossing.
Okay, I didn't know if there's anything. I got that they were similar looking. I didn't know if there's anything else beyond that. So yeah, you know, the closer she gets, right, the more the pain of not making it is going to be,
right?
And so I really related with the Hound here. So then we got the wedding scene, right? And they take off Walter Frey's daughter's cloak, and you kind of knew that it was going to be some kind of twist reveal, that an M. Night Shyamalan style twist that the woman would not be hideous, right?
Okay.
I mean, was this described in the books? Like, how did it go down?
Yeah, that she's comely.
Is that good? I forget if that's the good one.
That's the good one. Okay. Homely versus comely.
I
yes.
see. That's right. I always get those confused. So they get married, and Edmure is like psyched. And then a lot has been made of this look that Walter Frey gave to Rob during that scene, right? What did you make of that look? Because after he presents her, he gives Rob this kind of leering look. And do you know what I'm talking about?
I guess I didn't notice it.
Okay, Walter Frey.
I might have already been curled in a ball of tension and dread in my couch. So,
well, MVP listener Pat emails this in.
He says, our MVP.
Walter Pat. Frey was great. Rosalind was cute. Edmure was all, hey, ladies, be careful down there when being transported to the bedding. That was all amazingly well done.
Yes.
I thought everyone's performances were subtle enough to be interpreted in different ways. I've read the books, but when Walter and Rob exchanged glances during the ceremony when Rosalind was revealed to be a cutie, I know some people interpreted Frey's look at Rob as sinister, but I thought it played off more as an almost playful, you could have tapped that, buddy, look.
Oh, right.
If I had not known what was going to happen, I would not have been alerted. So actually, that is how I interpreted the look, because I did not know what was going to happen, and yeah. I thought it was kind of like a, you could have had that, man. You know, type of look.
Okay.
Not to say that that's any morally indefensible. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
More morally defensible, I should say.
Well, it's interesting the interpretations that you lay on things. Like, we can talk about this in 5 minutes, but the various looks that were exchanged between Catelyn and Roose Bolton, like, there were different interpretations if you knew it was coming and if you didn't.
Right.
Roose Bolton was shooting some very interesting looks. If you rewatch that scene, just watch Roose Bolton's face, like, during the reception. It's bananas.
Explain. What do you mean?
He just, like, there's a, like, when it all starts to go down, and we'll get there, but, like, when it all starts to go down, the actor who plays Roose Bolton, and by the way, I just saw on the Netflix series The Fall with Gillian Anderson, Roose Bolton is in that, and also the actor who plays Barristan Selmy. It's a great series. You guys should check it out. Anyway, Roose Bolton starts shooting Cass these looks, and then he, like, looks suggestively at his sleeve, like, take a look. Take a look what's up my sleeve. Like, it's so weird. Why would he do that?
Or maybe he's trying to be like, I hope she doesn't notice the sleeve thing.
Don't look at my sleeve. I'm going to look suggestively there. Don't look there.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I need to look. No, I need to look to make sure it's not that obvious.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Maybe.
If you're just tuning in live, you're listening to A Cast of Kings. You can find more of our episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. We're just talking about Season 3, Episode 9 of Game of Thrones. So, they have this scene where they're married, and then we have the reception, and everything's going great. Now, in the books, let me ask you, is it conveyed at all, like, how many of the Stark men are here at the wedding?
Yeah, and that's the thing. In the books, you get this whole secondary tier cast of characters, which you cannot introduce to TV watchers. It's just too many people to like track. But there are all these northern men that we've come to care about, like the Great John. Like all these people are there at the reception, and they're getting drunk and all this stuff. But it's Rob's people are there, and we know them as book readers, and so the stakes are higher. It's not just Kat and Edmure and Brendan and blah, blah, blah. It's a whole cast of Rob's friends and bannermen who we care about. And most of his men are outside in the tents as they convey in the show. But like he does have a force inside the reception hall. But they're all getting trashed is sort of what, you know, you're supposed to take away from that.
And here's kind of, you know, something I will say about this scene. There's many elements to discuss. We're going to dissect every single element of the scene. This scene actually made me care about the Rob and Talisa storyline. And you know why? Because there's a scene where like Rob grabs her arm.
Right.
And he says, oh, like, you know, this could be treason, blah, blah, blah. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit too. Is Talisa actually being treasonous? And, you know, there's this moment when Rob's about to go in for the French kiss, right? And Talisa says, no, don't dishonor them. Like, don't disrespect them that way.
Right.
And I just thought to myself, man, props to Talisa for that. Right?
Yeah.
Like, that is very, like, respect. Because she knows that Rob basically kind of pissed all over their agreement, right, by marrying Talisa. And so she's like, look, let's not make it worse by you making out with me in front of Walter Frey, right?
Talisa's like a freaking saint this whole
episode. Yeah, I mean, she doesn't react when she's like gawked at and, you know, verbally undressed. She's just totally, totally cool with everything.
Yeah.
And then there's that scene where she's like, I've figured out the name for our kid. It's going to be Ned. And they have this moment where he touches, you know, she takes his hand to her belly. And I think to myself, man, I'm finally starting to care about this character. What is this emotion I'm feeling in my heart, in my chest? It's not love. It's the opposite of love. It's like my heart is hard. You know? Anyway, that's an Arrested Development reference.
Yes.
So I start, and there's that kind of the way the camera does this thing where it focuses in on Catelyn Stark's face. As she looks at Rob and she's thinking, the way I interpreted it was she's thinking to herself, you know, everything's going to be okay. Like, my boy has finally grown up. He has his own son on the way. It's almost like, you know, like, despite all the horribleness with Ned, everything's going to be okay. That is literally what I was thinking when I watched the scene. And actually, if you go back and watch the scene, you realize that they do everything in their power, right? The showrunners, the writers, whatever, they do everything in their power to kind of up the emotional stakes of this scene, right? To lull you into a sense of security.
Well, both Kat, it's interesting that both Kat and Talisa and Rob bring up Ned Stark. Like, his name is evoked by both of them independently. And I thought that was a really interesting thing that happened.
How so?
Well, I don't know, like, Catelyn brings up, you know, Roose is talking to her about her bedding ceremony, and she brings up Ned.
Oh, Ned would never have allowed that.
Right. You know, like, they just evoke Ned's name twice, and it was interesting that happened.
Right. Let's talk briefly about the bedding ceremony. So, is this the same bedding ceremony that was supposed to happen at the Tyrion wedding?
Yeah, and Miles brought this up on the spoiler podcast that we did last week. Miles McNutt brought up how smart he thought it was that the Tyrion wedding played out the way it was. It sort of prepared us for this wedding. Like, we've seen a couple weddings now on the show. We saw Rob and Talisa, so we understand the vows, we understand the cloak thing, and we understand the bedding ceremony. And so,
well, we didn't really understand the bedding ceremony. We never saw it happen.
Well, Tyrion said no, but yeah, this is the bedding ceremony. Is basically they drag the groom and the bride off, and they strip them down and put them into bed together. So
yeah. So yeah. In the book, is it described like that they, do you know what I mean? I'm just wondering, like, in the book, is it like, are they carried off in the book as well? Or
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think I told you this last night. What happens in the book is that Rosalind Frey is crying the entire time. And Catelyn at first thinks it's because she's young and she's nervous. But then eventually when Catelyn cottons on to what's happening, she's like, oh, and that's why she was crying this whole time, is because Rosalind Frey knew what was going to happen.
I did not know people still use the phrase cottons on. So well done, Joanna Robinson.
Okay.
So they have this bedding scene, which I'm guessing is inspired by actual, you know, earthly traditions as well.
Yeah, I've seen it. I mean, I believe in the Kenneth Branagh production of Hamlet, they do it with Gertrude and Claudius. It's a thing.
It's a thing. It might not be exactly as it was executed in this episode, but there are similar human customs.
Right.
Non-Westerosi earthly customs.
Right.
I also did want to point out, actually, you bring up a good point, and I want to make sure we got to this moment. Let's take a step back. I hate to take us out of this, but I will just say briefly that we got a lot of emails in from last week's episode, or not last week's, 2 weeks ago, Second Sons, talking about how Tyrion Lannister, right, when he says, "And now my watch begins," to Sansa before he passes out, he was talking about
an unofficial vow of celibacy.
Yeah, that's right, a vow of chastity.
Right.
I don't think we pointed that out as clearly as we could have on the episode that we recorded last. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear.
Definitely.
Thank you guys for writing that in, writing into us at acastofkings@gmail.com. So they're carried off, and before they're carried off, Kat and Blackfish have this discussion about, man, Edmure, he really lucked out, you know? That could have been Rob sitting there. Or actually, no, that's what Rob says. But, you know, they're talking about how Edmure is a fool and blah, blah, blah. And they have this interesting dialogue with Roose Bolton, who's not drinking alcohol at the wedding. So that kind of your first red flag that something's off, right?
Well, we already saw him do that. Did we? I believe we saw him do that at the dinner he had with Jamie and Brienne. And Jamie was like, "Do you know how suspicious it makes you look that you don't drink?"
That's right.
Roose never drinks in
Fair
this
enough.
Show, canon. Yeah.
And Blackfish makes a reference to Roose Bolton's kind of the fact that he already married a Frey girl, right?
Right.
Who is large and worth her weight in silver and made him rich. So we have reason to believe that there is a Frey-Roose connection. So these are kind of like the hints that they're dropping left and right, right?
Sure.
That something bad might happen.
Yes.
So then Edmure and his new bride are carried off.
Right.
And then the door is closed in a fairly lengthy scene. And so you know something is wrong because, like, why would they give so much attention to closing the door, right?
Right.
And then the Reigns of Castamere starts playing.
Right.
Now, Joanna, you pointed out, as a lot of people have already recognized, that a couple things, right, wrong with Reigns of Castamere playing. First of all, it is a Lannister song, correct?
Right.
And
as they did such a good job showing in the last episode, Second Sons, Cersei goes at length, you know, great length to explain the plot of the song Reigns of Castamere.
Do you have that plot recollection off the top of your head by any chance, or a summary of it?
Basically, it's about how Tywin Lannister destroyed another house. It's a triumphant song written about the way in which Tywin destroyed another house.
Right.
And so it's a song of Lannister victory. And so to play it at a Stark function, at a Northerner's function, is a bad sign.
Right.
And something that you and I talked about before, but I think is worth noting, that I wish they had done in the show, is that in the books they make a lot of comments about how bad the musicians are. And the reason the musicians are so terrible is because they're actually assassins, like posing as musicians who have their weapons like hidden in their instruments. And so they talk all along in that chapter about how bad the music at the reception is. And I believe in the show and in the book as well, they play the Bear and the Maiden Fair as they take Edmure and Rosalind off for their bedding ceremony. But I wish the musicians had been worse. They even make comment in the show about how good the musicians are. And I really like – it was just a great bit of comedy that these were assassins playing terrible reception music because they were hiding their instruments.
I disagree with you. I think that that sounds funny and hilarious and stuff like that, but I think that it would have distracted from the overwhelming horror that you feel watching the scene. Like,
okay.
I do think it would have been like, oh, ha 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 ha, these assassins. And, you know, it would have felt like something out of Monty Python, honestly, right?
Okay.
If these, you're just like, okay, I disagree. We'll respectfully disagree.
It's okay. We can disagree.
Yeah, it's cool. So then the door is closed and the song starts playing. And that's when, right, you know something bad's going to happen. Right?
That's when Catelyn gives the oh fuck face.
Right.
The oh shit.
Yeah. And, you know, okay. So then comes probably one of the most disturbing scenes ever in Game of Thrones. Not only disturbing scenes, disturbing moments ever in Game of Thrones, and probably most disturbing things I've ever seen. Like, literally in my life, in terms of, like, in a television thing that I've ever consumed. Or a program or a piece of media that I've ever consumed. Which is, someone takes out a knife and walks over to...
To Talisa.
Actually, no. I'm sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself. There's a moment when Kat realizes what's wrong, and she flips over the sleeve on Roose Bolton and sees that there's chainmail underneath, right?
Yeah.
And that was a really great moment because a stupider show, and one of our writers in pointed this out, that a stupider show would have had Kat say something like, "Oh my gosh, chainmail! Something terrible is going to happen." You know what I mean? Like, they would have said, some dialogue would have needed to be conveyed. This show at least is smart enough to let you know that, hey, he's wearing chainmail. Something is clearly wrong here, right?
And then she slaps the shit out of him.
She slaps him, and that's nice,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I thought that was a cool moment. I mean, again, I hate to keep comparing to books, but did it happen that way in the book? Like,
she goes up to – it's not Roose Bolton, but it's someone else. She goes up. She has this building sense of dread. She goes up to someone. She feels his arm. Like, she feels his bicep, basically, or whatever, and she feels that there's chainmail there, and she slaps the shit out of him. So like,
I think this scene in this show is actually more effective than what you're describing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a visual cue. I mean, you can't – she describes it in the chapter.
Right,
you know what I mean? You can't do that. You have to have the visual in the show. So.
Right. And actually, yeah, you're talking about Roose Bolton and the looks that he was giving, right? And I actually didn't know if this was going to be like a Roose Bolton, Catelyn Stark kind of rekindling some kind of love story going on here.
I know. You thought it was a romantic.
I thought, you know, they're all chilling. You know, they're chilling out at the wedding. They're having a good time. They know each. They clearly know each other. They have a history, right? And it's like, who knows what can happen, you know, after everyone starts getting sauced and, like, it's the wedding night. And maybe they're going to – maybe sparks are going to fly between the two of them. Who knows? I literally thought that that was the case. Am I stupid for thinking this, Jonah Robinson?
No, I don't know. Like, it's very hard to interpret the looks he was throwing at her. So,
yeah. So, like, these knowing looks. Like, looks – they were knowing looks. We can say they were knowing looks. Right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so whether they were knowing about their romance or about her forthcoming death, you know, we can leave to people's interpretation. So she flips open the sleeve, and then she says to Rob, "Run." And when she says that, a dude comes up behind Talisa – and just starts freaking cutting her open, right? And the way the scene is framed is done in a way for maximal horror for a couple reasons. First of all, you see, like, if you do this shot by shot, right, you see the blade being drawn. You see the guy walking up to Talisa from behind. But the thing is, you see Talisa, like, the look on her face. There's totally no comprehension of what's happening, right?
Right.
And you it's kind of this moment of dramatic irony where you know something that the character doesn't. You know that she is about to get brutally assaulted, and there's just a second or two, might even be a split second, where, like, you know it's going to happen, and she doesn't know, and you want to warn her that it's going to happen. And that second stretches on forever. Anyway, they cut her open in a really distressing way, especially because they just talked about – you had already kind of started thinking about, what is this baby going to look like? You know, is he going to grow up? And you know, he and Robb Stark are going to fight the Lannisters together. They'd already set all this up. And so when they kill her – it's really, really troubling.
Yes.
And, I mean, look, I've had my I haven't been the hugest Talisa fan, but as I mentioned, this episode actually made me like her, right? And so I was getting
just in time.
Just in time for them to butcher her. Now, Jonah, I thought you had some really good thoughts about like how they did this, because in the book, Talisa is not a character, right? Or Talisa is a character, but she's not named Talisa.
Right.
So you want to explain that?
Okay, so in the book...
And again, we're not spoiling anything from future books.
Right. In the books, there is no character named Talisa. In the books, Rob goes off to the crag at some point, which happens in the show. But he goes off. That's where he finds out that he thinks his brothers have been killed. He gets really upset and basically, as I described it last night, grief bones this girl named Jane Westerling. And he's so overcome by honor that he marries her. And as Miles McNutt brought up in the spoiler cast last week, I think the main reason why the writers put Talisa in rather than Jane is probably to make it a more relatable plot line of like he fell in love with this cool chick rather than like he had sex with this woman. Because we don't understand, we don't relate, I don't understand to this whole honor bound.
Actually, I believe I pointed that out as well on the episode when we first discussed this. But, you know.
Okay, I'm sorry. And David Chen also, master dissector of things. Anyway, so basically, and then Jane is not at the wedding. And she's, this is complicated. I can't really talk too much about this.
Yeah, so let's just say that she's not at the wedding. Like
she's not at the wedding.
She was left behind, right?
Right, right.
And speaking of left behind, it's not entirely clear Blackfish's fate as of the end of this episode, because he goes to take a leak on a tree.
Right.
So does he survive? It's not clear in the show.
Right.
I might, based on what I know of TV shows, I would say that they kept him out of the, like they explicitly didn't show his death in order to either A, indicate that he did not die, or B, show his death in a more gruesome way next episode or something like that. But my guess is that it was on purpose that they did not show his death this episode, even though his death was implied because they imply that all the Stark people are dead. Okay?
Right. And I'm not going to talk about it.
Good.
Basically.
So Jane Westerling is left behind and doesn't come to the wedding, right?
Right.
So I got to admit, I went back and forth on this scene, Jonah Robinson, because I was so distressed by what I had seen.
Right.
I was really upset by it, right? That they not only killed this woman, but that I guess the fact that they had, like, they stabbed her in the belly, like, you know, killing Robb Stark's heir and this child, this unborn child. And it deeply upset me, and I talked it over with Angie Han, who writes for SciShow.com today. I was trying to, like, get my feelings out as to why I was so upset by it, right? And I think that the reason, and after talking through it, I still don't think it was like a necessarily rational feeling of upsetness. We've always heard stories of the medieval ages and of like the brutal sacking and pillaging of cities, and how, you know, women's bellies were cut open while they were still pregnant, and their children were killed in front of them and stuff like that. Like, I've read stories like that before from history books, you know, from various other sword and sandals things. You hear about stuff like that, but I don't recall ever seeing it in such a graphic way as I did in this episode. And I think the thing that really upset me was, if you're going to display an image that shocking, that sort of startling to common decency, you need to have a really good reason to do it. Like, you need to be a work of genius or a work of, like, unimaginable greatness to be able to show something like that and justify it. And that was kind of, again, I'm not saying that's a rational thought. I'm just saying, like, that was where I originally thought. And the idea that they had created this character of Talisa and made her pregnant just so they could kill her off in this scene, it just really rubbed me the wrong way.
Right.
But what do you think, Jonah Robinson?
Well, what I will say is something that you and I didn't have a chance to talk about last night is, there, as I mentioned earlier, there's a bunch of Rob's men in the hall with him. And also with him is this character named Daisy Mormont, who's in the book, who's not in the show at all. And she's sort of like a Brienne Light, where she's like this cool lady warrior. And she and Rob dance at one point and blah, blah, blah. And she takes an axe to the belly in that scene. Like, they kill her pretty gruesomely. So, no, she's not pregnant, but it's not like there isn't a woman who doesn't get a mortal wound to the belly in that scene. You know, I think a lot of people are like, it's beyond the pale that they put Talisa in there. The showrunners put Talisa in there when she's not in the book and stabbed a pregnant woman in the belly. Like I agree that that's ramping the violence up. But, you know, there is that slight parallel in the book. There is a woman who gets an axe to the belly, and it is very gruesome in the book. So it's not out of whole cloth that they invented this thing.
I see.
But I will say, you know, my theory has been that they put that Talisa scene in there to add shock value for the book readers. I mean, not solely, probably, but I think that's partially part of it. Because, you know, those of us going in who knew what was going to happen were not going to be surprised by Rob's death or by Kat's death. But we didn't know what was up with Talisa. We didn't know why they had expanded this character. We didn't know why she was at the wedding. We didn't know what was going to happen. So we, too, were shocked along with the rest of you when she got stabbed in the belly, because we didn't know that was going
to
happen.
And I guess, like, hearing you present that theory, I think kind of upset me, because I was thinking to myself, like, is that the only reason to include that? Like, is that a good enough reason to include that?
You know what I mean?
Just to shock and startle the book readers. That's why you showed us a pregnant woman getting stabbed to death in the belly.
Well, okay. Can I? I want to read this email from Sarah from Texas.
Yep.
Which goes into this and draws a comparison to an earlier instance, where she says, first off, just want to say I love you guys, and this podcast is required listening for me. I'd like to hear both of your thoughts on the violence of the Red Wedding and how it apparently differed from the books. I watched last night's episode with a bunch of book readers, and afterward they said that Rob's wife, can't remember her name in the books, not only isn't at the wedding, but isn't pregnant. So why make this Talisa's storyline? And why have her brutally murdered, her womb butchered as her shocked husband watches? It reminds me of the cruel, haunting fate of Roz, also not in the books. What does this additional violence truly add to the story, and why is it directed at female characters? That this is a dangerous world has already been well established. We get it. Is this kind of shock value necessary? It even ties in with the discussion of nudity in the show. It doesn't make one prude or overly critical to want to examine the purpose behind the use of nudity, i.e. adding it to scenes that play out fully clothed in the page. You have to ask, what's the point? Once again, that's Sarah from Texas. And I agree. Like, I understand. I understand where you're coming from, where you're like, I mean, you seem almost sickened that they put this in. Would you describe that as your reaction?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And I mean, I think Sarah's email gets at, so we got a ton of emails about the nudity thing. We'll probably get to a couple of them later on in the episode. But I think, you know, the show has used women's bodies, right? In various ways. Game of Thrones uses women's bodies to titillate. And I think someone else pointed out, like, it uses sort of rape as a way of horrifying the audience, as a way of conveying that this is a dangerous world that is brutal and brutal to women, right? And also right. To men. Let's not leave men out. But that in particular with the copious amounts of nudity, like, it feels to me as though Game of Thrones is not above using the bodies of women to provoke reactions in its audience, right? And not necessarily in an artful way. And so to see it in this way, it almost kind of like, I was kind of like willing to accept a lot, and this almost pushed me over the edge. Do you know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's where I ended up, but I mean, where do you come down on this? Do you think, oh, that was totally awesome, and I can't believe they showed, like, dude, did you see that? That was so, I can't believe it, but not in the necessarily, like, I can't believe it in a bad way, just like, whoa, how bold of this show to do that? Like, where do you come down on it?
No, I mean, I was crying, like, not sobbing, but I was crying through that scene. But what I'll say as a book reader is that scene is so shocking on the page. And so I don't know if they were just trying to match that on screen.
That scene meaning the butchering of all the Stark men, because Talisa didn't die in the scene.
Right, but Rob dies and Catelyn dies. And it's really, it's more gruesome on the page than it is in the show. And, but no, there isn't a woman who gets stabbed in the womb on the page. But here, can I want to read like a really brief part of the scene. And this is where Catelyn takes her revenge on, it's not Walder Frey's wife, it's his idiot son or grandson. But they describe the way that she cuts his throat. And it says, she tugged hard at Aegon's hair and sawed at his neck until the blade grated on bone. Blood ran hot over her fingers. His little bells were ringing. He wears like a jester's hat. His little bells were ringing, 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 and the drum went boom, doom, boom. The violence is described so gruesomely in the book that I think they were just trying to match that intensity on the screen. And if you see the way they slit the throats, it was, as you said before, it was almost like, I don't know, a Monty Python sketch where blood was just gushing from a cleanly slit throat. And it lacked that gruesome, grisly description that we get on the page. And I think the only thing that matched that was Talisa. And I'm not saying I'm glad they stabbed a pregnant woman in the womb. I am obviously horrified by it. But I think it was
But you get what they were trying to do.
I feel like it was their attempt to match what we book readers felt when we read that scene.
Right. There's an interview with George R.R. Martin. They did a pretty great job over at Entertainment Weekly.
Yeah.
Entitled Why He Wrote the Red Wedding. And somebody asked, what about the Red Wedding? Was it based on history? And George R.R. Martin says, the Red Wedding is based on a couple of real events in Scottish history. One was a case called the Black Dinner. The King of Scotland was fighting the Black Douglas clan. He reached out to make peace. He offered the young Earl of Douglas safe passage. He came to Edinburgh Castle, had a great feast. Then at the end of the feast, the king's men started pounding on a single drum. They brought out a covered plate and put it in front of the Earl and revealed it was the head of a black boar, the symbol of death. And as soon as he saw it, he knew what it meant. They dragged them out and put them to death in the courtyard. The larger instance was the Glencoe Massacre. Clan MacDonald stayed with the Campbell clan overnight, and the laws of hospitality supposedly applied. But the Campbells arose and started butchering every MacDonald they could get their hands on. No matter how much I make up, there's stuff in history that's just as bad or worse. That's kind of the line that I was – that's the operating line, I think, there, right?
Is right. That,
so at first, I vacillated a great deal. I was outraged. I was, like, really upset by the scene. Like, I felt like it was beyond the pale. It was like, you've done something unforgivable. You know, I went there. And then I kind of came back. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I kind of, like,
yeah,
reeled it back, and I was like, I calmed myself down, and I thought, like, you know, as a person who discusses this on a podcast, I'm allowed to question how well they executed something, right?
Yeah.
But should I question their – I shouldn't question their right to try and execute something, right? I shouldn't question their right to, like, to put a scene like this out there. I can question whether it was done well, whether it achieved goals, whether those goals were noble or valuable. But I felt I was going too far into the uncomfortable territory before. And I read this part of the interview to also convey that, like, it is just showing what has happened in real life before, that no matter what horrors you see on the screen, they cannot compare with horrors that, you know, humanity has actually perpetrated on itself. And that's ultimately part of why, like, what the show is trying to do, you know what I mean, is trying to show, like, how during – in this Westeros world, like, humanity can be brutal to itself. And it wants to make you invested in that idea. It wants you to root for good, but it also wants you to understand that sometimes there's no good to be found. So overall, I kind of, like, I started really angry at it because I was like, if you're going to do this, you need to have a really good reason. And I kind of came back and I'm kind of like, okay, it was just a really brutal scene and let's move on. So those are my thoughts on it.
The thing that I think is really worth noting is that Michelle Fairley, who has been not, or Catelyn in general, has been not the most accessible character, I think, in the show. And I think Michelle Fairley did an amazing job in the scene. I think we really felt for Cat and her predicament, and she sold the whole thing for me. I thought she was amazing. I thought her portrayal was amazing. And I really felt it. Like, even those of us who knew it was coming, like, really, really felt it. And I don't think that's just because, you know, they added the Talisa bit to it. I think it was really well executed.
Lord Walder! Lord Walder, enough! Let it end! Please! He is my son! My first son! Let him go, and I swear we will forget this. I swear it by the all gods and you. We will take no vengeance.
You already swore me one oath right here in my castle. You swore by all the gods your son would marry my daughter.
Take me for a hostage. But let Rob go. Rob, get up. Get up and walk out. Please. Please.
And why would I let him do that?
On my honor as a Tully, on my honor as a Stark, let him go, or I will cut your wife's throat.
I'll find another.
Well, let me say, like, I'm apparently one of the few people that was actually kind of a fan of the Robb Stark and Catelyn Stark characters. I'm reading here from Alan Sepinwall's review of the episode. Stupid Robb Stark made bad decisions without the consistency of the old man Ned Stark, and certainly without the screen presence. And Catelyn caused a lot of this trouble in the first place by taking Tyrion prisoner, and then badly undercut Robb's campaign by setting Jaime free without promise of anything. Michelle Farrelly brought more to the table than Richard Madden did, but ultimately I won't miss either of them nor Talisa.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, and I got to disagree. I was like, I thought the performances of these characters were so strong, and that Robb Stark, he was kind of a flawed hero, right? Like, he really wanted to bone this girl, right? But ultimately he was trying to fight for the side of good.
Right.
And so I was rooting for these characters. Right, like, we have been with them for so long. Like, I actually had developed emotional attachment to these characters. I was rooting for their success, and so I'm a little bit baffled by people who are like, "Yeah, I don't care about these characters. Who gives a crap about Robb Stark?" I just don't agree. You know, I felt for Robb Stark, and I think a lot of people on Twitter did too, and that's kind of what their reaction was.
Well, but even if you don't, there is that poignant counterpoint of Arya. Arya going around the grounds of the twins, seeing the Stark men butchered, seeing the direwolf butchered, you know, getting so close to her family and then seeing all these horrors once again, this poor girl. So, I mean, I don't think there's a single show watcher who doesn't love Arya Stark. And so if, at the very least, if you didn't give a shit about Robb Stark and Catelyn Stark and Talisa, you cared about Arya and the fact of what happened to her.
Well, she is going to have the mantle of the Stark storyline is going to be placed on her now. Like, that's the weight of that storyline.
Well, don't forget about Rickon, you know?
Oh, yes. Yes.
And Sansa.
Sansa and Bran. Do you know what I mean? But like, she's kind of – I feel like she's the only one that could really – she's – of those characters we just named, she's the only one that could plausibly come back against the Lannisters. In my opinion, right?
Well, and this is one case in which the show is not as cruel as the book, because the way the chapter, Arya's chapter, ends in the book, they say the Hound's axe caught her in the back of the head. So you don't know if Arya has died as well, but it's just him knocking her out so he can carry her off, which they showed in this episode. But it's like, you know, the axe caught her in the back of the head, and you're like, oh my God, did they just kill Arya too? Like, what the hell? George R. R. Martin. So, you know, at least in this instance, we know the Hound has just knocked her out and is carrying her off out of there.
Which, by the way, I just thought was a little bit – so it's no. I will point out a couple things. First of all, it's notable that in an episode where a direwolf is heartlessly murdered, that was like the least bad thing that happened in this episode. Like, in any other episode, that would be the worst thing.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you'd be like, oh my gosh, they killed a direwolf. That is shocking and appalling, right? But that is like, that kind of passes like really quickly. without much fanfare is like a testament to how much horrible things happened in these episodes.
I don't know. It was pretty upsetting. They showed his little face like underneath the stable door as he died, and the sounds he made as the music started playing, and then Grey Wind started howling. It was really upsetting to me. So,
I mean, I will say that, like, again, I love Arya Stark. I think she's awesome. Maisie Williams is amazing, but I do think that, like, I thought she was going to free the direwolf, and yet again, like, she has done almost nothing to affect the plot of this show, really. Right. Like, since the beginning. And I can only stand seeing her almost affect the plot of the show so many times before I stop giving a crap. Do you know what I mean?
You're lying. You'll
I can only see her cry wolf so many times. Do you see what I did there? That was pretty good. That was pretty good. The wolf thing. I tied it in with the...
I heard you. I heard it. Oh my gosh.
So another thing, okay, so that's one thing to point out is like that was like, you know, that was horrible, but it was like it was one of many horrible things. And the second thing is I just don't get what the Hound's MO is at this point. Like, the whole point of him taking Arya there was to sell Arya and get some money for it. But now that the Starks are all dead, what does it motivate him to keep hanging on to Arya?
No comment. You
know? Yeah, I know, no comment. I have a feeling we'll find out, but it is confusing to me. I'm kind of like, what is going on? What plans does he have for her? Maybe he just likes hanging out with Stark daughters, right? That's kind of his thing, I guess. So,
oh yeah, maybe it'll impress Sansa if he's like, look, I saved your sister.
perhaps.
Well, the other thing I wanted to say, about all that. Oh, is this famous line that Roose Bolton says before he stabs Robb Stark, which in the books is Jaime Lannister sends his regards. And in the show is the Lannisters send their regards. And a lot of people are suspicious that that's because the showrunners want you to like Jaime Lannister. You know, they've worked so hard to get you to kind of like Jaime Lannister again. But they don't really want his name evoked at this gruesome instance. And so instead he said the Lannister send their regards. So it's not quite as pointed, you know. But you'll remember that when Jaime Lannister is leaving Harrenhal, he says to Roose Bolton, tell Robb Stark, you know, the Lannister send their regards. And so I don't know. It's a very famous line from the book that they changed ever so slightly.
Wow.
To maybe keep Jaime Lannister's name out of the whole thing. So then,
this is, horrors upon horrors, like, Robb takes a bunch of arrows. Like, Robb kind of sees the Talisa getting stabbed. He can't really do anything. And then he gets, like, arrows through the chest.
Right.
And then Kat takes an arrow. And then all the Stark men start getting slaughtered left and right. And it's really gruesome. And there's this amazing shot where the camera kind of pans down. And you kind of get an almost slow motion perspective of the horror that's happening. Although I think there's been very little slow motion in the show in general. It's not in keeping with the aesthetic of the show.
Right.
But you kind of see it play out in gruesome single shot detail. And, you know, Robb stands up and kind of stumbles over to Talisa and holds her. And she's like basically dead at that point. She's like bled out. She's dead.
She's gray. They put some gray makeup on Una Chaplin. Yeah.
And it's really heartbreaking. It's pretty sad. So then Catelyn Stark, you know, wants to take some initiative and grabs single-handed grabs Frey's wife, who I didn't know she was Frey's wife. I don't remember if that was conveyed or like in an earlier like in the season one or two or earlier in this episode. I didn't know it was Frey's wife.
And I just thought it was some rando lady sitting next to Walder Frey.
Well, I almost feel like she had to say, I will cut your wife's throat, like identify her as the wife so that the audience knew, because otherwise most people might not make that connection. Right?
Okay.
And she threatens, she knows she has very few cards to play right now, right? All she has is this woman's life. And she knows what Frey is thinking. She's like, she appeals to Frey's logic, right? She says, look, I swear to you, if you let us go, we will not take any vengeance. We'll just turn around and never come back, blah, blah, blah. Because she knows she's not going to say, please let us go, because she knows that if he lets them go, they're going to want to take vengeance. So she goes straight for the vengeance, like counteracting. And he's basically like, or else what? And she's like, or else I'll slit this woman's throat. And long pause. And then Walter Frey says, you know, well, then I'll just have to find another. And wow, man. Like, we had already descended into the depths of human depravity throughout the course of the scene, but that line is, you know, it's the worst. And I say that with admiration, too. I'm not saying that, like, I'm not saying that, like, I was describing the cutting open to Lisa scene.
Right.
I'm saying that because it's like, what a way to just, it's like the cherry on top of this immorality sandwich. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, hey, you didn't think that this world was brutal enough. Guess what? This dude doesn't even care about his wife, man. Do you know? That's kind of like the icing on the cake. But the line was delivered perfectly.
Yeah.
So what did you think of that moment, Joanna Robinson?
I thought it was good. I want to give a shout out to the makeup department for Michelle Fairley's
face. Yeah, she looked terrible.
She looked terrible.
Yeah.
She looked amazing. Like, her face is just fantastic. So that was a really good job they did.
Yeah. So then Catelyn realizes that the game is over when, like, she doesn't even have that leverage, right? She doesn't have the leverage of this woman.
Right.
Rob dies.
Yeah.
And then she does the only sensible thing that you would do in that scene, which is she cuts Frey's wife's throat.
Right.
And that scene plays out, I think, with no music, no dialogue. She cuts her throat, she screams, and then she just stands there for a second, and you're kind of just waiting for it to happen, and then this dude just comes up to her and matter-of-factly slits her throat.
Right.
And first of all, I thought, like, when did Takashi Miike start directing Game of Thrones episodes? It felt like a Japanese horror film to me. You know,
it felt
like, for those who don't know Japanese horror, it's like Kill Bill Volume 1, you know what I mean? Like,
that
kind of thing where, like, oh, matter-of-factly slitting someone's throat and it all spurts out and they just die instantly when you slit their throat for some reason. But the kind of wordlessness, you know, there's just like, it was chilling. It's chilling, right? Because it's there's no words. Cut her throat. She falls to the ground lifeless. There's no, like, it's not even execution style. It's not like there's no pomp and circumstance. It's just you're dead. And that's like, it's like a transaction. It's like you're freaking paying for your Starbucks coffee. Do you know what I mean? Like, that was the emotion that soldier put into it.
Does that mean that the last word we hear in the episode is when Rob goes mother and then dies? Like, is that mother is like the last line?
Not 100% sure about that, but that's entirely plausible to me. Yeah.
And sorry, you know,
are you getting emotional right now?
No. But, well, you know, I love to say it, but in the book, Kat goes completely mad and starts clawing her own face off. And I feel like they almost kind of kill her out of a mercy. Like, I don't know that they would have killed her if she hadn't gone completely bananas when Rob dies and starts clawing her own face off. And then they're like, ah, just end it. And then they kill her. And so it's less of this silent, matter-of-fact transaction. I don't know that they would have killed Catelyn if she hadn't gone mad in the book, you know? So that's a difference. But it was very chilling. And then, of course, the
cut to
absolute
black.
Silence.
And, yeah, cut to black, total silence.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, how, you know, and good for them. Like, you know, I've seen this for me, it was like when you saw a 24 episode, right? An episode of 24 and someone died in it, which happened frequently. Like, the final countdown clock would be silent. It was kind of their way of showing respect, almost. And there was this whole, like, debate about who would get the silent clock and who wouldn't, right? And in this case, the silence is, like, totally deserved, right? Because there's no – I mean, they just killed off a bunch of characters.
Right.
A bunch of characters that we've gotten to know over the course of the last season.
Right.
So totally shocking. Now, before we move on from this episode – so is there anything we have to say about the scene, Joanna? Anything else we have to say about the scene before we move on? Because I do want to talk about the Lannister honeypot theory.
No, I have nothing else to say about the scene.
Okay, I mean, overall, I think it was really well done. And I think listeners need to decide for themselves whether I almost want to say that you got to decide for yourself whether the show is good enough to earn something of this brutality, right? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, is what I'm saying fair, do you think? Right, that if you're going to use brutal graphic violence and you want to be thought of as a respected show, like, the show almost needs to earn it. I don't know.
It's the difference between, like, a CSI or an NCIS or whatever. I don't know what they show on those. Like, I don't watch those procedurals, but I've heard that or Law & Order SVU or whatever. I heard they're very grisly and gruesome versus, like, Hannibal, which is in itself a procedural, but it's very grisly. But the grisliness is artistic. And so the question is, are you doing this for shock value or are you doing it as part of really good art, really good affecting art, effective and affecting? And I think in this instance, the way that people have reacted to this episode, as you started this episode saying, like, this is going to go down in history as one of the most talked about episodes of television ever. And so in that sense, I think that they achieved their goal, you know? Like,
yeah. I mean, I just the one sort of impulse I felt when I saw this episode was like, this show now, like, the entire run now, it's up the game for itself. It needs to be a great show to earn showing this.
But it's been a great show.
Yeah. No, that's right. That's right. So that's kind of, again, I'm still kind of like, you can tell, like, listening to me, I'm still, like, very torn about how I feel.
Yeah,
about this.
You're processing it.
I'm still processing, right?
I understand.
And honestly, if you ask me this,
book readers are still processing it, like, years and years later. You know what I mean?
If you ask me, like, two weeks from now how I felt about the scene, it would probably be a different response.
Yeah.
Right? Sure. Now it's like less than 24 hours after I've seen it, so my response will probably be different. And maybe, again, I openly acknowledge that I may be irrational and maybe, like, being unfair to what I'm asking for the show. But
you're having – this is what we humans call an emotional reaction, Dave. You're having an emotional reaction and it's okay, right? And you're trying to process it analytically, but I think you need to be emotional for a little bit and then be analytical, you know? It's an emotional – like, it's an emotional story that they told. It is a visceral emotional story that, like – almost every person who read the book threw the book across the room because it was so emotional at that moment. And so I don't think you can make a calculated, critical judgment of the episode yet. I think it's too soon.
Yes.
So
I need a little while, guys.
We can talk about it next week.
I need a little while. All right. So there's been a video floating around the internet, General Robinson. It's called Roose Change, the Lannister Honeypot, right? Or the Lannister Honeypot Theory.
Right. Which was my favorite thing ever, and I'm really sad. Well, whatever.
So someone posted this video, and it spoiled a couple things. Like, it spoiled the fact that Roose Bolton was involved with the Lannisters. Now, the thing is, I knew that Roose Bolton was involved with the Lannisters before this episode. I mean, you definitely – let's just be fair and say, as of this episode, you definitely know, right?
Right.
So I knew that it was happening going in, but even though I was prepared for that, I did not – like, it was still good. It was still good. You know what I mean? Like, the way the reveal happened was still good.
Yeah.
I will say it was a little weird how he kind of stepped in and kind of, like, stabbed him and then just, like, stepped away. You know what I mean?
It was like a dance move.
That was a little odd.
Yeah.
But aside from that, the reveal was still good. Anyway, this video, which we'll embed in the post, which you can find at GameOfThronesPodcast.com, posits that Talisa was planted there by the Lannisters so that she would seduce Robb Stark and so that he would break his vow to Walter Frey, thus paving the way for a Lannister-Walter Frey alliance, right? Now, I think we can intuit that some form of a Lannister-Walter Frey alliance has occurred, right? Because Roose Bolton said the Lannisters send their regards. Clearly in cahoots with Walter Frey. So we can intuit from the show that there is a Lannister, Frey alliance. So the question is just whether the Lannisters sent this spy in to sow this dissent before it happened. Joanna, why don't you talk about this? Talk about what your thoughts on it were when you first saw it, and kind of what your thoughts on it are in it now.
Well, as we already mentioned in this episode, the Talisa character is a greatly expanded version of the Jane Westerling character in the book. And so we book readers were sort of like, what the hell is this woman doing here? Why have they expanded her role this way? So when this video popped up at the beginning of this season, it started floating around right about episode one of this season. A listener actually sent it to me on Twitter. And I loved it. I was so excited. I really wanted it to be true. And if you watch it's great. Like, because there are all these scenes where Talisa's writing letters, and there are all these scenes where Tywin Lannister's writing letters. And the person who edited it together made a really convincing case.
I will say it is as well edited together as Loose Change, the film that it gets its title off of. but is it as believable as Loose Change is the question.
I wanted to believe it, basically. Like, I was really ready to believe it. And so there are still people who are holding out the hope that it's true and that Talisa just got, like, was a loose end that got tied up, basically. That maybe she was a spy, but, you know, they killed her anyway. I don't think so. I think that would not happen. But anyway, I loved that theory. I'm sad to see it die. But it was an entertaining thing for those of us who think we know everything. We smug book readers who you guys all hate because we already know everything.
I burn with hate for Joanna.
I know.
Every week.
This is like a lingering question and mystery for us. And so I'm bummed to find out that Talisa's not a spy, or if she is, she's dead. But anyway, the Lannister honeypot theory is one of my favorite things that happened this season. So rest in peace, Lannister honeypot theory. I'm sorry to see your demise.
So let me just say, like, if you're listening to this podcast, I think at this point, right, we didn't want to mention it before this episode.
Right.
Because
right.
Before now, you didn't know about the Roose Bolton Lannister connection.
Well, Dave had like texted it or IM'd it to me like a couple weeks ago. I was like, don't watch that, Dave. God damn it. There are spoilers in there. But it was too late. But yeah, I was trying to keep it from people because I think it was very spoilery.
So now that you know about it, you can watch it. And I will say, yeah, the video is very good. Like,
yeah, it's really well done.
It's really like entertaining too. Do you know what I mean? It's funny, like the way that it's edited together. And I got to say, it's quite convincing.
Yeah.
It is quite convincing. Like, it's almost it almost takes more of a stretch to, like, after watching that video, it's almost more of a stretch to not think it's true. You know what I mean? Because, like, all the evidence that has been laid out.
Right.
But there's a few counterpoints of evidence, right? Like, could they have possibly predicted that Rob would fall in love with this random chick, right?
Have you seen Una Chaplin naked? Of course they could have.
Point number two, like, was getting pregnant part of the deal? You know what I mean?
Well, was she really pregnant? I mean, that's the thing, is like, when this was all happening, I was like, is she lying to him about being pregnant? Like, these were all the burning questions that I had. Like, I thought she was just fucking with him. Like, if she was a master spy and a huge biatch and was just lying to him about being pregnant the whole time, like, that was my suspicion. Or the other possibility was that she was a spy who was sent to seduce him, but then she fell in love with him anyway because he's Richard Madden and he's so dreamy, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there were all these question marks.
But I mean, so I guess one question is, do we think that it is too late for the show to fill those blanks in? Because I think it's definitely getting close to the point where, it, like, at this point, how would they even fill in that exposition? Like, oh, by the way, Talisa was a spy the whole time. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I think the Lannister honeypot theory is dead.
Yeah, you don't think it's ever going to be mentioned again?
No, I think
That's your bet. Did she actually fall in love? Did she get pregnant? You know what I mean? Like, all these things. These are sort of counterpoints. And also the fact that she got killed.
And what I will say, as we've already mentioned, Jane Westerling is not at the wedding in the book. And so what I'll say is that there are all these book theories about Jane Westerling that are now called into question.
Okay. I don't know what you're talking about, but I think that's okay.
I mean, that's all I'll say is that now, I mean, this was monumental for all the Jane Westerling theories that were out there for book readers. So
I see. The fact that the character based on Jane Westerling was killed.
Exactly.
So it does fascinate me, like the Roose Change video, and like whether it was real or not. I don't know.
It's so good. For all of you who haven't watched it yet, please do watch it. It's so good.
I mean, even if they don't actually refer to it in the show, it could still be true. Do you know what I mean? And this could be a situation like Bourne Legacy style, where they try to tie off all the loose ends, right? But it's like, hey, we hired this person to like mess up Rob's life, but now we can't have this person just out there anymore. Although I guess it doesn't really make as much sense in the context of Westeros, right? Why couldn't they just take her back? Do you know what I mean?
I don't know. We'll have to see, I guess.
This isn't like the CIA. Do you know? it's not like people can't have knowledge.
I think it's, once again, MVP Pat from Maryland who said they gave Talisa a burn notice, like the spy Talisa a burn notice. So
what is a burn notice for those of us who are familiar?
When you execute a spy, basically.
Yeah. All right. So I think that's our discussion of Season 3, Episode 9, Reigns of Castamere. Anything else we want to say about this episode, Joanna?
I think that's it. I think we've said it all.
We've been going for quite a while. We have some emails to go through. Oh, we're almost at 2 hours. Jeez. It doesn't even feel like we've been talking for that long. But I will say that this is what it is like. Watching this hour of television is like kind of the apex of modern television watching, right? To be caught up in this kind of emotion and this kind of despair, along with like, you know, millions of people out there, right? Like, to be caught up with them, to see their anguished tweets, right? To see their terrified reactions on YouTube, right? To be participating in like the zeitgeist, and like everyone's writing about it, like as if something shocking happened, right? Like, this is what it's all about, man, right?
As if this were like a real life event that had happened,
right? Right. And like, that's kind of the best of TV, is like, it can bring millions of people together in this shared moment.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful. I'm grateful that we have been able to be a part of it. Do you know what I mean? To have experienced this episode together and to react to it together. It's kind of, and to see all the emails like pouring in despair. It's like, it's a special sort of feeling that you only get to experience like a few times. And as someone who like takes cultural or pop culture analysis as seriously as I can, it's really cool to be a part of. What were you going to say, Joanne? I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
And I was going to say for book readers as well, like this shared experience. It's something special that George R. R. Martin created, this universe where you come to care about these characters and the way in which he fucks you over. Over and over and over again. And it's why we have been so excited about the show all along, is because this is it's just masterful storytelling. It really is. So,
well, I love this piece at The Onion, right? Do you see The Onion piece?
Which one?
It's a column by George R. R. Martin, and it says, the title is, "Oh shit, I totally forgot that happens." Right. and it's written by George R. R. Martin, and he's like, as the author of the popular Song of Ice and Fire series of fantasy novels, it has been a pleasure and a joy to watch Game of Thrones, HBO's riveting television adaptation of my work. Every week, the show delights viewers, myself included, with a series of stirring performances, deftly maneuvered feats of storytelling, and eye-popping special effects. It truly is a joy to watch my novels, my life's work, come to life on screen, rendered with tact, faithfulness, and considerable filmmaking skill. That being said, holy fucking shit, I totally forgot that whole thing about the Red Wedding. Christ almighty, talk about a punch in the goddamn gut. I must have been sitting there for 20 minutes afterwards just completely numb with disbelief, like, what the hell did I just watch? I mean, is it that brutal in my book? I honestly don't remember. The whole time it was happening, I was literally just staring at my television in shock, thinking, son of a bitch, I forgot about that. Three of the story's main characters are murdered in the most savage and horrific fashion imaginable. My wife and I were sitting on the couch, and we both just turned and looked at one another. Whoa, that was intense. I mean, I vaguely remember writing something like that, but that was years ago, you know? You forget these things. Anyway, it goes on. It's very funny. I'm not sure exactly what point it's trying to make, other than maybe that even for book readers, it's still like, holy crap. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
That is a brutal episode. So, anyway, those are our thoughts on Season 3, Episode 9 of Game of Thrones. Let's dive into emails, shall we, Jenna Robinson?
Dare we?
Got some emails here. So let's talk about Ben's email. Ben R's email.
Okay.
Hey, guys. I know I'm a week behind, but I just listened to the Second Son's review, and I really thought you were missing something with regards to the is nudity necessary conversation. Thought I'd share. First, I do agree the whole sexual element in the scene with Gendry and Melisandre is totally unnecessary. However, I thought it really played a big part in the scene with Dany and Daario. Much as it was used in the first season to make her seem weak and taken advantage of, I felt the nudity really put her in a place of disadvantage in the scene. If she was simply in her tent, she most likely would have had Jorah and or Ser Barristan there or nearby, and would not have seemed nearly as vulnerable. With Dany naked in the bathtub, it puts Daario clearly in full command of the room at the beginning of the confrontation. By the end, Dany has taken full control of the scene, and Daario is kneeling in front of her. Because being naked in the bathtub is about as compromising a position as you could possibly be in, it makes the transition in the scene even more powerful, and I think it really works. Not to mention the fact that Daario somehow, amazingly, keeps full eye contact with her the whole time, shows some extreme respect for her. It's just my humble opinion, but I thought it was a useful piece of storytelling. What do you guys think? Jenna, what do you think?
No, I agree. I think I was a little harsh on that scene. And I had forgotten an earlier scene that does happen in the books where she talks to Jorah completely. I mean, basically stark naked. So it's not unprecedented. And I agree that there are ways in which it's used effectively and ways in which it's not. And it's not fair to lump it all together. And I think that scene, I think it was done very well. In that scene. So that, I mean, that's what I've come to on that, is that I still think it's worth, checking in on those scenes and whether or not they're necessary, because I think sometimes they're not and sometimes, it's used just for titillation, but I think it does serve the plot in that instance for sure.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think I agree with this person's point. We got a lot of emails about the nudity discussion. A lot of, males angry that we would suggest that the show is misogynistic in any way, and no females writing with that perspective, interestingly enough, and a lot of people sort of defending you, Joanna, for your points that you made in 2 weeks episode ago, right, about how the show is sometimes gratuitous in its use of nudity. And I think that just it will be a debate we continue to have, much to the chagrin of many people, but there are many opinions well represented out there, and you know, it's something we'll have to take on a case-by-case basis, wouldn't you say, Joanna?
Yeah, absolutely.
Got a couple of other interesting emails. Alistair from Scotland writes in, I noticed when Joffrey's speaking to Sansa and makes a cheeky rape comment, he refers to himself as a Lannister. Quote, "It doesn't matter which Lannister puts the baby into you. Maybe I'll pay you a visit," etc. Does this mean he has definitely come to terms with how Jaime is in fact his father? I'm sure he dismissed the story before as lies. I don't know if you can comment on this, Joanna, but yeah, I think that's worth noting that he identifies himself as a Lannister.
Right? Yeah, I think it's worth noting for sure.
But yeah, what does it mean about himself? Not 100% clear. So anything else we want to say in terms of last week?
I don't know. I feel like this episode just obliterates everything else. And what I want to talk
about... What about the nudity, Joanna?
I don't want to talk about that this week. What I want to talk about next week, though, is... And I want you... This is your homework and everyone else's homework. Is to think about this episode 9 construction that Game of Thrones keeps coming back to. And I feel like it's a pattern we've seen, not so much in season 1. I mean, you and I didn't pick apart season 1. So, you know...
Maybe we will one day.
But maybe we will, guys. Do you want to listen to that? Anyway, but season 2 and this season, it's been this you getting frustrated or a little bored or whatever, and me saying, no, episode 9 is coming, episode 9 coming, episode 9 is coming. And then episode 9 comes and blows your mind. And so it's that narrative structure of, is that good storytelling? Is that worth it? Is, you know, I just think it's worth noting. And are they going to do that again next season? Is it going to be episode 9 again next season? Like, can they keep doing that? Right. I think it's worth sort of looking over. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I think, like, to be fair, I do complain about a lot of things, but I do also point out things that I really like about the show.
I'm not saying you don't like it. I'm just saying I think it's not just you. It's all people who don't know what's coming are like, what is this? They're talking again. That's not an accurate description of you, but I think it's just this simmer, the slow build, and you have to have all the pieces put into place. And then it's the annoying chorus of the book readers who are like, it's worth it. We promise it's worth it. And then the question is it worth it? And I think the answer is yes, because people keep coming back to Game of Thrones. But I don't know. Sorry, I'm a little sick, so excuse my
It's all good. I wanted to read one last email, Joanna, about last week's comments I made about Joffrey's sexuality, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Willow from New York writes in, I've been meaning to write in about this for a while, but Dave questioning Joffrey's ability to perform sexually was the clincher. I don't think we're meant to see Joffrey as an asexual being. In fact, I think we're meant to see him as just as hormonal and with as much sexual desire as the next teenage boy, just with very twisted tastes. Violence and sex are very intimately bound for Joffrey. He has Tyrion's whores beat in front of him. He shoots a crossbow with Margaery and is clearly very attracted to her during it. And when he decides to kill someone, he doesn't have one of his guards bring some peasant in. He goes to Littlefinger, who sells sex. This puts Joffrey's scenes in a different light for me and makes those more sexual scenes necessary beyond reminding us that he's a villain. He's not just cruel, he's aroused by violence, which makes me so much more terrified for both Margaery and Sansa, particularly in this episode when he talks to Sansa about paying a visit to her bed. Yikes. So I wanted to bring this up. Some people commented on this and how, yeah, like, Joffrey is clearly aroused by violence and cruelty. A lot of people also commented, Joanna, and wrote in about your complaint about Joffrey being a dick during the Tyrion wedding scene, right? Because you basically complained like, oh, don't we get it? Don't we get that Joffrey's a dick? Like, do we need to keep having it beat into our skulls? And a lot of people wrote in saying like, well, what else would you expect him to do? Like the show, some people would argue that that's actually good characterization. It's just showing this character being consistent. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it depends on a case by case basis. Once again, I don't know. But a lot of people. Let me think about that. Can I talk about it next week? Because
marinate on that.
Yeah, let me think about it because a lot of people have written in and made some good points. So. But I want to ruminate on it a little
bit. Okay, we'll return to that next week.
Okay.
So that's going to take us to the end of this week's episode of A Cast of Kings. You can find more of our episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. Thank you for the 200-plus people who tuned in live to listen to us chat about this episode. And again, find more of our episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. You can also find us generally where podcasts are able to be downloaded. On iTunes, on Stitcher, on Windows Phone, on Android, you know, all the platforms you can find us on. And stay tuned to hear what book of the week Joanna Robinson is going to recommend. In the meantime, Joanna, where can I find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can find me every day on Pajiba.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at QuitYourJRob.
Find me at DaveChen.net, Twitter.com/DaveChensky, that's Dave Chen, S-K-Y, and join the Cast of Kings community at Facebook.com/A Cast of Kings. That's Facebook.com/A Cast of Kings, a non-spoiler community, and a lot of good discussion going on there on a week-to-week basis. So join Facebook.com/A Cast of Kings. You can also use that page to keep track of what we're doing during the off-season, because there might be stuff happening during the off-season. So stay tuned for that. And that is going to bring us to the end of this episode. Joanna Robinson, for people who like Game of Thrones, do you have any books to recommend to them?
I did. This actually comes from a listener. Pat from Maryland, our Game of Thrones, Cast of Kings emailer MVP, emailed this recommendation, which I agree with, which is Jack Vance, the Dying Earth series. And he said it reminded him a lot, and I agree, of the Roger Zelazny Devilish of the Damned books. Roger Zelazny, I think, is the first author I recommended this season. So Jack Vance, Dying Earth series, check it out.
Thank you guys for listening to this episode of A Cast of Kings. We will see you guys next week for the season 3 finale of Game of Thrones.